nothing, as far as I'm aware, to do with Google. So if there's some weird thing that Google has its fingers on and you want to get around it, do a quick little search in your search window on your computer for Internet Explorer, the browser, not Edge, and see maybe if that works.
Okay. Sounds good. Do you have a possible version number or something I should look for?
No, they all should be good. Whatever your computer has updated it to before, you know, eventually they're going to rip it out of our systems with an update. But they haven't done it yet, as far as I'm aware. I always keep a copy of Internet Explorer around just in case. Every so often there are these strange websites that were designed primarily for that browser, and they break if you use something else, usually kind of archaic websites. But all you have to do is go into your little start button, type in Internet Explorer, make sure that it's not giving you the file manager program but the web browser, and then give it a try. That'll at least take Google completely out of the equation, as far as I can figure.
KD2FIU.
Yes, George.
I believe version 11, with all the latest updates through the end of 2019, through January 2020, Explorer version 11 with updates through January 2020 is probably the latest. Gentlemen, thank you very much. It's given me something else to look into when my Parkinson's is not causing me to shake like a leaf and when I have a clear head. I want to thank everybody out there. 73. This is NO3NO.
Okay, Tom, good luck with that. And once again, I just tried it myself. You just go into the Start button, type Internet Explorer. It'll show you a web browser. And hopefully that should be it. Like I said, this is one of the last non-Chrome-based web browsers out there. All the others seem to have the skeleton of Chrome inside them. So I don't know. It's very curious. I find it hard to believe that there's some master server out there. I tend to think that it's just something that they've built under the hood to protect us all from ourselves, that's misreading those files as corrupt. Let me ask you another little question before you leave. As far as I could figure out the chat room while I was talking simultaneously, Chris was indicating that are you having even a problem if he emails you those programs just using Gmail?
This is NO3NO. Affirmative. The database from one company for a code plug came through clear, no problem. The one for the mouse driver and the one for the programming software, they were blocked at the door like if they were the big bad wolf.
Okay, that's very, very, very curious. I'm wondering, I see Chris in the chat room. Chris, have you thought maybe of compressing them into a RAR or a ZIP in a way where it wouldn't be kind of obvious what the original source material was, or is Google too smart for that?
K2FTP. They're ZIP files, Roy. But unfortunately, they're smarter than that, and they go in them and look. They see the EXEs, and they strip the files. That's what's going on. So his server's stripping them. I don't know what ISP he's using, but they're stripping everything from them. So I emailed them in separate files. I emailed them together, tried everything. They get blocked.
Geez, talk about Big Brother.
Yep, you got it. That's Big Brother at its best.
Yes, and he's protecting us all from ourselves, us weak-minded little strange people that we are. And they'll be damned if... That's a shame. I don't know exactly, and I'm not quite sure exactly why would it be difficult for Tom, but relatively easy. You were able to download the files. I'm able to download the files. So I'm not 100% sure of exactly what the hell is blocking him there. And, you know, I find it hard to believe Google has just kind of focused on his IP address. Anything's possible. Could be that his ISP provider has these weird filters on in their front ends.
I can't answer why he can't download them. He should be able to do that. And I suggested Foxfire because that one's very clean. It should be able to get through Foxfire, even if he has firewalls and things on. But emails, I could see them blocking EXEs. A lot of them do. But he can probably fix that if he goes into his Gmail, go into your Google account, and turn off all the safety features and allow downloadable programs. That's probably a setting in Gmail. I don't use Gmail, so I'm not familiar with it, but I'm sure it's in there somewhere.
He mentioned consulting with his company security guy. Is this a company-supplied computer that may be locked down a little bit more than our personal machines?
Very well could be. Tom, can you answer that?
Yeah, I can answer. I was just waiting for the ID beep to go away. No, this is a machine that I bought at great expense. It's owned by me. It is not a company machine. Never was. It came burned in with Windows 10 on it. Good size hard drive at the time. I've expanded it, and it's going strong. It gives a few hiccups every now and then. But it sure as heck is making Linux look a lot nicer.
Okay, so we have here a mystery. I don't know exactly my sense, it's either being blocked by something on Tom's computer or something being blocked on Tom's ISP provider that they have draconian antivirus software that probably is not very good. Otherwise, I can't fathom Google in its infinite wisdom sitting there and wandering around and choosing different ISPs or different IP addresses to invoke Big Brotherhood.
Well, you heard the old joke. I'm from the government. I'm here to help you. And the other part of that joke is, and they promised not to, well, I don't want to say that over the air. But you get the drift.
Okay, very good. I just want to remind me about something. One of the problems is that you've never used this radio before, and so you don't have any drivers for it. So that's one of the big things that you need is the driver so that you can program it, right?
Affirmative. NO3NO. I bought it, I got sick, I had to put it aside, and I thought I'd play with it before, I'm pushing up the daisy, so to speak. And these son of a gun, it seems like they're doing everything to make my life difficult.
Well, as another thought, is there someone in a house with a different computer and a different ISP who might let you just kind of download it from their site and just hand you over a thumb drive or something? In the old days, they used to call that sneakernet.
Yeah, I'm familiar with sneaking that. Unfortunately, because I'm so isolated where I am, the old sneaking at days of, yeah, copy me this file and I'll do it for you. Those days are long gone. We used to do it when I used to service these things, but that was in the days of 286 and 386.
Ah, yes, the bad old days, before the I-7s and 5s and 3s and 9s.
You got it.
Okay, once again, I wish you luck. I don't know what to tell you. I would strongly suggest that you give the Internet Explorer a chance just for the heck of it. Probably, if your ISP is filtering it up ahead of you, that's not going to solve things. What actually would solve things, but it's would be a pain in the backside, is maybe you can configure a VPN. Some VPNs cost money, but there are VPNs that don't cost any money. They're not terribly fast. You can then hide the packets within the VPN, so if it's a problem in your computer, that won't help. But if it's a problem in your ISP or anything along the line, you might be able to sneak it through. So have you considered VPNs?
Not until you've mentioned it. I've got a couple of, it shows you how long I've been working on this. I can't even think straight. I've got a couple of Raspberry Pis around. I might be able to configure those to a VPN and get it by. Put it through Linux and play the heck with Google.
Okay, I don't think that would solve it, though, because then you'd, at one point or another, you'd be putting out non-encrypted packets into your ISP. The VPN would just be local for your house. I was thinking of, if you Google VPN, there's usually a bunch of free VPNs available. Again, they're not very fast, and they're usually trying to upmarket you to a faster one with money. But for the short haul, you could run a VPN that's free. It's external to your environment, so the packets that you send the foreign VPN will all be encrypted, so your ISP won't recognize what the hell you're sending. So that might be a workaround.
Yeah, I remember seeing that on, is it okay to give a plug to a non-political, non-denominational web page?
Sure. Yes, Tom, feel free.
I guess not. Okay. But I remember this one fellow, he set up a VPN using Raspberry Pi. So desktop computer, Raspberry Pi, internet. And as far as the internet was concerned, it didn't hold the data in any form. So that the Google computer wouldn't be able to see it.
Okay, but you still would need something on the other end translating it. The way virtual private networks usually work is you can either do it through the interface of a Raspberry Pi, or you can run software on your computer. Your computer will encrypt the packets and send them to the virtual private network at a given IP address someplace in the world. That server takes it, knows the decrypting keys, turns it back into packets, runs the packets out, so it gives the location of that IP address, which isn't connected anything to your ISP. It gets the responses from the servers at its IP address, encrypts it, and sends it back to your IP address. So you would need to have some component external to your ISP in order to a VPN work properly.
Sounds like a plan. I'll do that tomorrow morning. when my brain is somewhat clearer.
Okay, good luck, Tom, and please come back and tell us how it all came about. I hope you'll have good news for us, and I hope you enjoy your DMR. I'm not really familiar that much with that model. Right now, the two big models that you get a lot of people with code plugs is the TYT MD380 and the Anytone 878 and 868. UV, I think, is the designation. So those you can find code plugs all over the place. It might be a little bit more problematic getting a decent code plug for your local area, but I wish you luck. And please feel free to come back, and if you have any other questions, feel free to share.
I will. I'll come back next week. I'll let you know the fruits of my labor. The funny thing is, I bought the HD1 through Amazon. The only problem is they don't have any ham to take the orders. So if you ask a technical question beyond what's printed on the webpage, you get the, profound dumb look, what you used to see on Radio Shack calls.
Yeah, Amazon is a very good place. I buy almost everything through Amazon. But when you want something that has to be a little bit handheld, you either buy it from them through a distributor like something like Bridgecom, or you buy it directly through people like Bridgecom. Bridgecom systems, again, not that I'm plugging them, but they have extensive tutorial videos, and they have people who answer questions. So technical stuff where you want responses, I don't go for the least expensive Amazon item. I go for something that's backed by a hopefully United States company that speaks English. Because, there are very well-meaning people from across the world who can't really speak English, and they might want to help me, but they don't have the faintest idea what I'm asking, so they really can't.
Affirmative. The order takers, they're generally in Malaysia in a call center, and they do an excellent job of answering the calls and forwarding them and all that. But when you ask a customer technical question, your luck is no good.
Yeah, I understand. I mean, that's a major problem. If you want to return stuff, Amazon is great about that. If you want to understand how something works or how to get it to work, these people are not trained for that. They're simply trained to either give you an excuse or to give you your money back. More times than not, thankfully, they give me my money back when there's a problem, so I'm happy with them. You just have to know which cases you really want to buy it from a distributor who's aware of what it is and how it works, and even sometimes might be able to fix it. So keep that in mind, everyone, when you're wandering through the pages of Amazon. Look for who the actual seller is, and if it's some strange person in China, that's going to take you about 3 months. If you don't think that you're going to need any technical help or assistance of any kind, so be it. Otherwise, go closer.
If it's not warranty support he needs but configuration issues, check for user groups on places like groups.io or Facebook.
Yeah. The thing is, I need those three files, the code plug, the programming software, and the USB software that Google is seeing as applications deleterious to computers. And they block those too.
Oh, well, what can I tell you, Tom? I hope one of these workarounds work for you. I haven't quite been in the same situation, but geez, that would drive me insane. I would probably just move from computer to computer to computer. But if the problem, as I suspect, is ISP-based, you kind of stuck. Again, what the hell? Try Internet Explorer. That should take you maybe 10 minutes. If that fails, try the VPN. They're not that difficult. I've used them before. I now use a commercial VPN because I prefer to operate behind a VPN. Gives you a little sense of security. Not much, but a little. Okey-doke. That was a fun technical segment. I thank everyone who participated tonight. And now, WS2N, please give us the SpaceNet report.
Okay, Roy. And at one point, Tom was asking you if you were going to find out if you wanted to know about a good website. But you didn't come back to him. I don't know if you were on the chat room or something at that. You might want to just go over that one missing piece of traffic back to you.
Okay, Tom, did you want to plug a website?
I guess he went away, Roy.
Okay, I'm trying to do 15 things at once, so I might have missed that. I'm sorry if I did, Tom, if you're listening somewhere out there in the ether. So, Paul, please, give us your SpaceNet report.
Okay, this is W. This is SpaceNet. And let's see, we have a few things that are new in the last week anyway. Like the Ingenuity helicopter on Mars. You know, that's the one that was brought up there by Perseverance, this big 2,000-pound rover that's now driving around on Mars. And the helicopter has been very successful. It flew five successful missions, each one getting more and more daring. And it's really worked out very good for JPL at NASA. So they wanted to do a sixth mission. They decided, we'll go off the experimental versions and we'll actually do an operational mission to help out the rover, fly ahead and see what's up there. So they did that. They programmed it, and it was supposed to take off, go about 33 feet in the air, then travel about 500 feet in one direction, and then it was going to slow down, and it was going to start taking pictures with the camera that comes out horizontally, and then they were going to fly another 150 feet in another direction, and then come down and land. And so they programmed it, and sure enough, they're around during the day when these flights take place. It took off, and it was going that 500 feet, but at some point, it made it through its whole flight. You know, it got as far as the 500 feet, and then it translated the other 150 feet, and eventually came back down and landed from its 33-foot height. And it landed in a new location, about 16 feet off from where they were. So they were analyzing the telemetry that comes back. You know, it gives them the voltages and the amperages and, plenty of information what the computer was doing. And they realized the thing, when it made the flight, it was rocking back and forth. But at the end, it stabilized, it stopped rocking, and it came back and straight down and landed. And in the software, they have accelerometers and all kinds of stuff to keep this helicopter going in the proper location. They know which way it's turning. But one of the features that they use for flying is they have this camera. They have two cameras, one looking out on the side that takes color pictures. And then there's another camera that looks straight down. And that's the navigation camera. that takes pictures at 30 frames per second. It's not video, you know, although, you know, your regular TVs are, you know, 30 frames per second, but that's how fast it takes the pictures. And it analyzes each one. The computer makes 500 calculations per second, and it lets the helicopter know where it's located. It's using these pictures and comparing them to the onboard pictures on the computer, and it knows where, you know, where it's located, and that helps its navigation. But at one point, one frame for some reason got lost. They analyzed this all after the flight, of course. One frame was missing, and that threw all the other ones off. So it cascaded all the way down the line, and each time it got information back from the computer. Computer was telling you, well, it's in the wrong place, and it thought, you know, it wanted to go one way or back the other way, and it kept doing that. What saved it was when the helicopter lands, they have it programmed for every flight that, you know, when it goes into the landing mode, it shuts down the navigational camera. So then that information stops becoming a problem. So it stopped rocking back and forth and just dropped straight down. By the way, when they let it down, it drops down at 1 meter per second. It doesn't like come down and just hover above the ground. They pretty much almost let it drop. It drops at 1 meter per second. And this way, when the legs hit, the legs tell the computer, okay, I've landed, and it shuts down the rotors. But it worked, you know, that part worked perfectly. So now if they want to use this helicopter again, it might be some time, but they're going to analyze what's wrong, and knowing these people at Jet Propulsion, they might be able to find a way around this. But, you know, that was the goal, to push this thing as far as it could possibly go. You know, originally it was only flying like a couple of miles an hour. They've had it up at like 9 miles per hour in one direction, the length of almost 2 football fields. Instead of 40 seconds and, you know, going up and straight down like they were in the beginning, it's doing like over 2 minutes of flight on its, 6 lithium-ion batteries, rechargeable batteries, with the solar panel on top of the blades. So it's very successful, and I'm hoping that they get a 7th flight out of this thing. So that's the story on Ingenuity, and I'm sure within a week or two I'll be able to get some information from Jet Propulsion on their website and find out if Ingenuity will eventually fly again. I'm sure it will. Anyway, this is WS2N. We'll go on to the next one. Okay, unless somebody has a question about it, either Ingenuity or Perseverance. Okay, anyway, you have Virgin Galactic. They've been around a while now. Definitely around 12 years now at least. And that's the one that's run by Branson, Richard Branson, a fellow from England. And they've been working on this rocket space plane. What they do with that is they attach it to a carrier, a jet. They have a name for the carrier jet, the White Knight. Carrier jet has these, jet engines attached to it. And it carries this rocket plane up to 45,000 feet, around 9 miles, and then they drop it. And then after they drop it, the carrier plane pulls away, and the motor is ignited. It's a hybrid motor, which essentially is like a mixture between a solid rocket and a liquid rocket. You know, it has the advantages of both.
You know, if it was a solid rocket, you know, and they lit it off, they wouldn't be able to throttle it. They wouldn't be able to shut it down if they had to. With this one, they can. But it's not a liquid engine. It's got like almost like a paraffin or wax type of, or you know, mixed with a rubber type of fuel. And then they have nitric oxide tanks, which feed the oxygen. And by manipulating those two, they could actually throttle it either up or down or even shut it off. Anyway, the space plane Unity, I have a name for it, will be able to carry 8 people at one time, pilot and co-pilot, 6 paying passengers. So, right for now anyway, it was just the pilot and co-pilot for a test last week that they did. And it was successful. They got up to, it was around 58 miles high, which is, they consider anything above 50 miles space. There's another group that considers anything above 100 kilometers or 60 miles space. But they got up to around 55 miles high. And then they eventually come back down. It's suborbital, and they come back down and land. But the reason this was a big deal for them, it's the first time they've flown into space in 2 years. You know, they've been improving the space plane. They've moved from Mojave, California. This thing has flown into space before, but from Mojave. It's the first time that they've come to their permanent home base, which they've planned on moving here years ago. And their home base is in New Mexico. It's a place called Spaceport America. And Spaceport America was built probably 15, 20 years ago. They envisioned this. It was built by the taxpayers of New Mexico. And they've only had like a few unmanned rockets launched from there, but it's the first time they've actually launched somebody officially into space after all these years. They thought it would be a much busier place by now, of course. But, you know, in the space business, predictions are awfully, often they go awry, and next thing you know, it's 5 or 10 years later. But they finally did it, and the next flight will be coming up probably in about 3 or 4 months, I guess. They need to work on anything that they evaluated. They might change something, and they plan on at least one more flight with a couple of crew people that work for Virgin Galactic. And if that one is successful, I'll run another test flight, and this time with Richard Branson. He's always wanted to fly, you know, in his space plane that he's been developing. So we'll see how it goes, because if that works, and they'll probably have another maybe test or two after that, they will eventually start taking paying customers. They'll be able to go to Spaceport America, stay in their facilities, train for a couple of days, that's about it, and get into this space plane and make it to space. If you make it over the Kármán line, for instance, that's 100 kilometers, you know, they consider you an astronaut. So that's the story with Virgin Galactic. Any questions?
RBP, you mentioned Spaceport. They actually have a Spaceport USA in Cape Canaveral, Florida. You drive your car there and then down to the Cape to do the tour.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. That's been there a long time. I went there in, I guess, probably the 1970s, but, which was very nice. And I would imagine it's a lot better nowadays. But, there's spaceports all over now. You have You have one in Vandenberg Air Force Base. You know, as far as the United States goes, you have another one now in Wallops Island, Virginia. We have another one in Alaska. Now they call it the Pacific Spaceport. Used to go under another name. And, they want a few more in the United States. They want to develop one in Georgia, a place called Camden, Georgia. That's a long way off. There was one company that was planning to launch out of there, you know, like by now, a company called Vector, but they went broke, and they're not going to do it. But, somewhere down the line, they might eventually come online as well. But, did you ever go there? I forget your name. And to RVP, WS, come on.
W2SY, maybe I got it wrong. Yes, I'm looking at it right now. I got married to wife number one in 1992. We only married 7 years. I went to Florida for our honeymoon. I went down to Orlando to Disney. I think I was there. I got married the 16th. The second day I was in Florida, I drove the rental car from Orlando, from Disney, took the B-line, kept going east. I guess I got to the Spaceport USA. I took the tour. I actually look at my full computer. I even have my logo for Microsoft Office 3 at work. I got a Saturn rocket. I took a photo of it. And I took it from an angle. And I've had this photo for like 30 years. It's really cool. I think it's monstrous, I tell you.
Is that the one that they had laying down horizontally with the five big F1 engines sticking out of it?
That's the one. That's it. I got it laying right. I'm looking at it right now on my computer. You know, I got some wallpapers that I use. But at work at Southern Community College, and we use a Microsoft Office 365. So you want to have like you can put your photo. Like when people see, so I use the Saturn rocket. Maybe it's technology. That's my logo. You know, when people see the logo.
That's pretty cool. Very good. I'll make you have a QSL card made up like that. You should see my QSL card. I have a picture of the galaxy. Well, go figure. Very good. Any other comments?
That's it, really. You know, but I also think, actually related to ham. It is ham radio. Back in, had it be? I'm trying to remember. Had it be 95, maybe 96? I had a friend. This friend of mine, friends with. I came home late, and they were launching the shuttle, and Lark, the Islanders Republican, a full member, would rebroadcast the they had a box, and they would rebroadcast the NASA broadcast of the launch. So they said when it launched, 7 minutes into, it was like 1:30 in the morning to launch. So 7 minutes in the launch, you would see the shuttle coming up. Sure enough, I saw the shuttle coming over the sky. It looked like a shooting star, but I saw it. It was really cool.
Okay, yeah, I did as well. And then the engines were actually still on. Cause, you know, I remember those flights. They're the ones that the ones that were in that 63 degrees inclination, and they were the ones that you could see. And especially if it was a little dusk, and what you were actually looking at, you might remember this. You the engines were still on because the engines would shut off at eight minutes. They called it MECO, main engine cut off, and that was usually 8 minutes and 8 minutes and 10 seconds. So at the 7 minute mark, you could still see the light, like you said, like a shooting star. And then maybe 30 seconds after that, the engines would shut down. So it was still. You would think, you should still be able to see, but what was happening, the engines were shutting down, and now you couldn't see it anymore. yeah. Is that pretty much the way it went?
That's why I was in a parking lot in Mayfair Gardens, kind of see the lights. If you were on the South Shore, it would have been probably a better view, but I could see it, you know. It was pretty cool. It was really neat, you know. It was a neat experience, you know. So, you know, really, really cool. Back to you.
Yeah, very good. I went to a school parking lot this way. You know, I knew there wouldn't be any trees around there, and I was able to see it. And then I had the radio on, you know, mobile, and I was talking to another guy in Patchogue at the time. Like, well, he was on the South Shore. So, you know, got to see it at the same time. But there were a couple of them like that. When, you know, a lot of the shuttles went, especially the early ones, went at 28 degrees. We didn't see them. They went, you know, pretty much east. But the ones that were, would tend to go north, even some of the ones that were going toward the, you know, to the International Space Station, which was 51 degrees, you had a shorter view, you know, a little harder to see them. They would disappear quicker. The ones that were heading closer to a polar orbit, not quite 63 degrees, were the best ones. Very good. All right, let me move on, unless somebody else has a question. Or you, back to you. Okay, I know China's been in the news lately a lot. They're really pushing ahead on their space program. But as much as they're in the news, they're never going to catch us. I hope not. We're still way ahead. But, you know, recently they put up their space station, Tiangong number 3, that third version of the space station. In the past, they've had two. Just one module went up. They docked with it a few times with the crew, and you know, see how it worked out. And then they didn't stay long. The crew would come back, and eventually the module deorbited. Actually, that one deorbited by itself. Willy nilly, they lost control of it. But you know, it didn't hurt anybody. Tiangong number 2 went up after that. And that had they had a docking port for to test out a cargo vehicle to see if they could dock with it. They did that successfully, and they said, "All right, I think we just one crew up. There was just two taconauts, they call them, or you know, that's the word for astronaut in China, the taconauts. They sent two of them up." And then eventually that thing deorbited properly. So that was their test to see if they could do it. Now they sent up their permanent first module, first of three. And I think they're eventually going to put more than that. But they're first of three big modules. First one went up last month. And that was the one that they used the Long March 5. And that was the one where the core stage was, you know, 100 feet tall and, you know, 20 tons still floating around, going around Earth in orbit that they, again, they had no control over. And wherever it lands, and happened to land in the Indian Ocean. That was the one that made the news. Anyway, that was a rocket that put the spacecraft, the space station, Tiangong 3, into its orbit of 42 degrees, different inclination than the International Space Station, but successfully did that. And their next mission is to stock it with cargo and to refuel it, put fuel into it. And they have a cargo version similar to what Russia launches, called the Russia launches the Progress cargo vehicle. This is very similar to that, except a little bit bigger. And they successfully launched that a couple of days ago. They tried about a week ago, but they had some technical problems. They shut it down. They scrubbed that mission. And then this one did go up and successfully docked with the space station. And it's got supplies and food and everything that a crew would need. And now it is docked and attached to the Tiangong 3 space station. And next month, which I want to see, we're going into June now, but probably within a couple of weeks, China's going to be sending up the Shenzhou, they call it 11 or so. They've had, you know, multiple flights over the years since 2009. Correction, 2003 was their first manned mission. So anyway, the Shenzhou is the name of the spacecraft. They'll launch on a Long March, I think they use the Long March 7 rocket. No, correction, Long March 2F. That's their crew launch vehicle. And they're going to send three people up to the space station. And they plan on eventually leaving the crews there for maybe 3 months at a time. And eventually stretching it out to 6 months at a time. So that crew will be replaced. You know, they'll come down and another one will go up. Similar to what we're doing. So if that's successful, then they'll eventually launch another big module up there to dock with the now existing space station, and another one after that. I think it's going to be T-shaped in the beginning. So they'll have plenty of room up there for a crew of three. They're trying to design it for a crew of six, but I think they'll need a lot more modules for that. Anyway, very shortly, humankind will eventually have permanently 10 people going around in orbit. You know, we now have 7 people. It used to be 6 as far as a couple of years ago. Now we're up to a permanent 7 on our International Space Station. And China will have 3. So at any time, there'll be 10 people flying around in space. And every now and then, I give the passes and time. You could look at the space station when it goes overhead. I know tomorrow night it's supposed to be a good pass. I believe that it's supposed to be clear out as well. But I think it's going to be in the 9 o'clock area. I'll have to, look at my tablet. There's quite a few websites that you can go to that will tell you the next time the International Space Station will go over your head. And tomorrow night's supposed to be a -3 magnitude, which is pretty bright. So I'll look for that anyway tomorrow. And my guess is there'll probably be a website for the Tiangong space station. As it gets bigger, it will be easier to see. The shuttle, when we were talking about that before, when they used to launch and used to come up north, up over the Atlantic, what we were seeing was the actual engines being lit, or still lit, before they would go out, before they would get to orbit. What you see with the space station is the reflection of the space station from the sun. So it's only either morning or evening that you usually see this, just as it's getting dark. So whenever that time frame is, now it's late, it gets dark at 8:30 or something like that. In the winter, it's different. Whenever it gets dark or early in the morning, you have to look for the passes, and you can see it go overhead quite clearly. It's like a big star. Sometimes it's almost as bright as Venus. Any questions or comments? This is WS2N.
that's why I've got to tell you. I have. I'm trying to do something. That's the one I don't want. I have. Where I work at Suffolk, his name was Robert Hoot Gibson, the shuttle commander. He did a Sarex mission. He spoke to a professor. He was a professor I had at Suffolk for communications courses in electronics. He actually went up on a team. The college, they gave him a county flag. And he took the flag up on the shuttle. He came back to the college and presented it to them. We have a planetarium at the Brentwood campus of Suffolk and Colt in our Saturday Arts and Science School, the Hoot Gibson Planetarium. That flag that was, that Suffolk County flag that was carried in space is actually outside on the wall in a glass display.
Just lost the last word or two. Let me see if you're still there. Yeah, who gives it? Yeah, I think he was from the island, but astronaut. And yeah, they do things like that. I know after 9/11, I think it was STS-108 took up hundreds and hundreds of small flags, and eventually came down and they were given out to the police departments, different people. Understood. And that's always there's plenty of things they do like that. But most importantly, from what I see for us anyway, is most of these guys are ham radio operators. So you always have a ham radio operator on board the space station.
Roger, into RBC for ID. No, who gets an actually went to Suffolk. She got his degree in engineering science in 1967. Then he went obviously to other schools. I became an astronaut. And what used to really tick me off is when I went to high school and I was going to Suffolk, then I had to get my grades up, so I had to go there first. I knew students that were really top students that were going to school, like Binghamton. They even won, this one guy could have won to Naval Academy. And they were smart in one way, but they were ignorant in the other way. They knocked, Suffolk is 13th grade. Well, some community college, not because they have bad grades, they go there because it's affordable, and they go there, maybe they can't afford the room and board, or they just want to see, and then they transfer. And this guy was one of those people that went there, excelled, and he became an astronaut. And that's how it goes.
Very good. Very good. I'm a big Suffolk Community College fan anyway. I like that school. By the way, they at one time they used to give ham radio tests there. You know, Suffolk County Radio Club. I took a couple of tests through them, upgraded. We used to go there. But, I like that campus. Very good. All right, we'll continue on. Let me talk about Starlink here for a second, with all the thousands of satellites that SpaceX is putting up. Stand by. Yeah, okay, they're up to now over 1,600 satellites, 1,600. I think it's 1,677. They just launched again the other day, and they put another 60 satellites up. They keep doing this over and over again. And I don't know if they're in a mad rush before somebody stops them. There are people complaining. There's other entities that want to do the same thing. They want to put their satellites up, and they're saying, well, you know, you're gonna have so many up there. We're gonna have so many up there. We're gonna have interference with one another. There should be an environmental plan before we're allowed this to continue. But no, they're going full blast. And not only them. Now you have a company called OneWeb. SpaceX is doing it, and now OneWeb has now got, I think there are over 200 satellites. They've been doing like 30, I think it's 33 at a time. Difference is they're launching on different rockets. They'll launch from French Guiana in South America on an Ariane rocket by European Space Agency. They pay them to launch. OneWeb is also paying the Russians to launch. They just launched from Voskhodny complex in launch complex in Russia, which is like eastern Russia. You know, it's like 4,000 miles away from Moscow. Nowhere near their other launch complexes. In fact, this is so far east. It's getting close to Alaska. So they developed a new launch complex out there. So I would say probably about four or five rockets have launched out of Voskhodny so far. And they're starting to put more and more up because this company wants to put I don't know how many satellites they want to put up. I think not as many as SpaceX, but, you know, hundreds of them. So between them and SpaceX, they have an ultimate goal of putting, you know, 30,000 up. You have Kuiper from Amazon company. They want to put up their own satellites. It's all for broadband. So you could hook your computer up, and there'll be low latency. So when you have, if you're playing a game, for instance, gaming, it will be instant. You know, that's the main purpose of keeping the satellites so low. They're only like 350 miles up, and there's going to be another layer around 400 miles up, and another layer after that. This is what they want to do. And eventually people are going to be paying, I think SpaceX wants like $100 a month, plus another $140 or something for their antenna.
Time complete.
And so, before you know it, they said after 10 years you're going to have 60 or 70,000 satellites flying around the Earth at low Earth orbit. So I'm starting to think that they have something by protesting this. They should really find another way around this situation. You got a situation with the astronomers. They're going to have trouble seeing seeing what they're looking at with satellites flying in front of their billion-dollar telescopes. I don't get it. But that's what they're doing. It does have one good thing. There's like 2 or 3 billion people on this earth that do not have broadband capability. Either they're in some country that doesn't have it, or they're out in the middle of nowhere where they don't have cable. So they will be able to get online. So that's the plus, but the downside is thousands and thousands of satellites are in orbit. I don't know how they got this approved, but they did. I'm really surprised. Before he started, when I say he, Elon Musk with SpaceX, they had roughly 1,000 satellites that were operating. SpaceX now has 1,600, over 1,600. Inside of a couple of years, he's doubled the amount of satellites in space, or tripled them. And now with, this other company, you're going to have, and it's going to be real bad if something ever crashes into another one, because it creates a cascade situation. One's going to hit another one, and, it will ricochet into another one. You could have a major catastrophe. But I hope not. They say everything's well planned. All the all his rockets have ion thrusters on it, with xenon as a fuel. Oh wait, they're not using xenon. They're using believe it or not, krypton. that's their fuel. Krypton is the fuel, not the it's a cheaper fuel than the xenon that they normally use for ion engines. So, you know, if they